Booze? No.
Hey, happening now. We want to welcome our viewers from across the United States and around the world. This is the EdTech Situation Room. Good morning, good day, good evening. This is EdTech Situation Room, episode number 303, August 30th, 2023. And my name's Jason Neifer, and I'm stunned into a stupor of silence, apparently, but I am the executive director of the Montana Digital Academy, which is Montana State Virtual School, located on the beautiful University of Montana campus, right here in cold and rainy Missoula, Montana. So who knows? I imagine that my colleague and friend, Dr. Wes Fryer, joining us from North Carolina tonight, I imagine you're getting some rain.
Indeed, we are. Just a few remnants of the hurricane. We're not getting anything too severe, but yes, I'm Wes Fryer. I'm a middle school STEM teacher here in Charlotte, North Carolina at Providence Day School, and very excited to be looking forward to a Labor Day weekend break coming up. And we have open house. We haven't had an open house for parents in person for 4 years at our school. So we've got it tomorrow night. So anyway, it's, you know, COVID is not gone, but we are, those that have experienced it have experienced, as far as I know, quite mild and light cases. And, you know, school is on pretty much normal, aside from, you know, culture wars and all kinds of other things, and AI and all kinds of other things going on. But in terms of, you know, schedules and classes and being able to be face-to-face and all of that good stuff. So I thought it might be appropriate. I don't have a hurricane background, but I've got my Edisto Beach background, thinking about those that have been in the path of the storm this past, 24 hours. So what are we up? No, but are you guys, so if it's rainy, does this mean the fire season's over? Because usually don't you wait for rains for fires to get put out?
Yeah, it's funny you should mention that, because just before I hopped on tonight, I did notice that some counties north of Missoula County were canceling their fire warnings, and because of the rain available in the region. And the rain we picked up from the Pacific Coast hurricane a couple weeks back actually really put out a lot of fires in Montana. It's not quite all the way out yet, and of course we get a lot of smoke from Canada and Washington and Oregon and Idaho when there's fires there. But yeah, we're definitely heading in the right direction here, and I will knock on some wood right now that maybe we avoided it this summer. We have a fire situation more summers than not anymore, but it would be pretty great if we managed to avoid that completely.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, hey, I'm excited to say for the first time in maybe months, we are actually caught up on our website. So at the end of every show, we'll say, hey, you can go to edtechsr.com, download audio and video versions and blah, blah, blah. And honestly, Jason, part of it is thanks to you sharing Claude.ai, because it is phenomenal. I'm now able to just copy my prompts. And I mean, it saves me at least 30 minutes a week. Sometimes I would like start listening to the show and I would, you know, be processing it and summarizing it and links and all this kind of stuff. And anyway, it's a big deal. And then before the show, I was oohing and aahing because Jason's Geek of the Week maybe 2 weeks ago was about upscaling graphics. And one of the things that I've noticed, I like to use Google Slideshow slides that I download as either PNGs or JPEGs as thumbnails on videos. Well, if you end up seeing those in a large format, it's actually not that many pixels. And so today I made a little tutorial video for my students and then upscaled it 4 times using this free AI tool. And it's just phenomenal. So if you don't do anything else, folks, you want to check out the Geeks of the Week because they just might change your life.
And, you know, when we talk about geeks, we have that in spades here at the EdTech Situation Room. So, well, Wes, we're here to talk links. And by the way, if you'd like to check out these links, you can go to our website, edtechsr.com/links. Check out our Google Doc, where we always have way more links than we have time to talk about them. In fact, I'm pretty sure that Wes and I could do a daily EdTech news show Maybe in retirement, that will be our fate, is to sit around as old geezers and talk about the ed tech and the good old days with our Windows 95 boxes. But
the old days.
The old days. But this week, we, of course, have AI news. And I've started kind of categorizing stuff a little differently, that when it's about Google and AI, that that should go under Google. And when it's about Microsoft and AI, that should go under Microsoft, because I think that context matters a lot now. And also, I have something to share maybe in a week or two. I'm putting together, admittedly, a rudimentary, but a framework for starting to discuss AI in a more nuanced way when you're in education. Because I think one of the problems we run into with how extraordinary these tools are is that it becomes such an almost a parlor trick that can really dazzle the eye. And then you start to lose that there are really a lot of ways to approach this, and probably education is going to have a multifaceted approach. The way we might integrate AI in our teaching and learning to help students grasp the tools is a very different conversation than how we're using it as knowledge workers and professionals in the education industry to help our productivity. They're related, but I think that they may end up being different discussions, and you shouldn't let the complexities of one impact, you know, the way you might use it for another. And so I started talking today with a colleague of mine at work, and just kind of think about what that might look like and how we're going to do that in coming days, weeks, and months. So we have some AI news. We have Google news. I have a fascinating AI tool I want to share today that I discovered yesterday that, and I say this a lot, but this one, it's really true, absolutely blew my mind. So we'll talk about that one. Some Apple news. Apparently something happened in a couple of weeks that I'm sure that the fanboys on our show tonight will be super excited about. Microsoft news, social media news, some notable nuggets, and of course our Geeks of the Week. So Dr. Fryer, is there any particular topic you'd like to start with today, or should I dive in full tilt?
Let's just let you jump right in. I'm a little late to getting my links in, so.
Okay, sounds good. Well, first and foremost, I would like to wish Google a happy 25th birthday. And August 2023 represents the 25th birthday of Google. The search engine, which was a Stanford graduate project originally called Backrub, has been around for 25 years now, and making our joke earlier about the old guys talking about the old days of ed tech. Well, Google was the old days of ed tech. And for those of you that weren't as connected to the internet in the 90s, there used to be a lot of search engines available. Web crawler comes to mind. AltaVista, MetaCrawler was a famous one because it searched many search engines at once and aggregated the results. So all sorts of early search engines. And I had a friend of mine who works in tech. He's now in tech and marketing. And we were talking, and he said, "Have you heard of Google?" And I said, "No." He says, "It's really a lot better than all the other search engines." And as it turns out, I sat down and had this beautiful minimalistic interface and very minimalistic advertising. There used to be a lot of jokes in the late 90s that, the pop-up ads would kill you. The early internet, especially after it became a little more advanced with, we started moving away from dial-up and towards more broadband, like DSL was an early popular broadband option. And the internet was dominated by advertising in a way that was annoying in a different way than it is in 2023. And oftentimes there'd be pop up or pop under ads that, you know, you would close your window and there's at least 19 ad windows waiting for you to close. I'm trying to remember. I think the product was, there was a camera system called X11. That was full of ads all the time. And then in the early days, it wouldn't be unusual to be on a very legitimate website and get a completely inappropriate ad for pornography, erectile dysfunction drugs, I mean, the whole range of things. And, you know, that's why, you know, the early pioneers of internet and classrooms, including Dr. Fryer and myself, you know, we had to teach kids not to be freaked out by that. And it's okay to end up in a dark alley of the internet. When you notice you're there, you just slowly back away and close the window, right? No need to panic. No need to freak out. Freshman in high school, you know, that's the way you have to do it. And the internet today is arguably way safer, or you could argue way worse, depending on how you want to look at it. But the early internet was certainly much more Wild West. And Google was the first attempt, really, its first successful attempt to try a more minimalistic approach. Their algorithm that was based on the inner structure of links and what linked to each other. And once something had established authority, it could provide other websites authority by linking to it. It's a very interesting and complex math problem. And we still don't know today what the Google formula is. They keep that a pretty close-knit secret, and it apparently is adapting and evolving all the time. But Google is 25 years old. And obviously now it's more than a search engine. It's a whole suite of tools and, you know, also a pioneer in artificial intelligence.
The fast story that reminds me of, I was teaching at Rush Elementary School. It was probably maybe 1999, 98, and I had not heard of Google. And a friend of mine from college, Tim Kaine, who was actually the reason I got on the debate team, a couple years ahead of me, I had sent an email or something and talked about this Google thing. I was teaching in the elementary school in a Windows 95 lab. I had kids come in, fourth, fifth, and sixth graders half day. And then I worked with teachers and discovered Google and realized, oh my gosh, it's a new world. So that was a a pretty big deal. So kind of wild. Wow, 25 years. And that's almost, 25 years of ed tech. So we're old guys here.
Yeah, we are absolutely old guys. That's so very true. And, you know, Google's not been without controversy, but it would be very difficult to make any sort of claim that that Google hasn't had a shocking and extraordinary impact on humanity. And you could say for better or for worse if you wish. But I do think that certainly notable that we need to kind of keep an eye on, how things have played out. So, okay, I have a couple other kind of Google AI related articles I'd love to talk about. First of all, is a great article from the Washington Post from August 29th. And Google's working on a method or a mechanism. And by the way, this is a gift link. I'm a Washington Post subscriber. So it's working on a technique to help divide up when an image that's been generated by AI and shared, that there would be some sort of watermark that exists in the file. And right now, the tool is called Synth ID, SYNTH ID, Synth ID, that they think could be part of the solution. And so essentially what happens is that there's a digital watermark directly under the image that can't be seen by the human eye, but it's picked up by a computer that's been trained to read it. According from the article, Google says its new watermarking tech is resistant to tampering, making an easy step towards policing the fake or the spread of fake images and slowing the dissemination of disinformation. And, you know, we've already seen a lot of impact on the 2024 election by generative AI images on both sides of the aisle, I might add. So it's certainly something important. I'm also looking at a quote from Representative Yvette Clark from New York, who says that clearly the genie's out of the bottle, but we just haven't seen it maximized in terms of weaponization. And I think that's a fair characterization of where we're at right now. I think the wonder of the tools oftentimes covers up what perceived abuse or disinformation is generated by it. But I think this is a good step to go in the right direction that, we need to be very thoughtful about when we're using generative AI. And I've now spoken a dozen times or so in the last couple of months on this, and I talk to people about how I always cite an image with AI, that I make sure that I say it's a generated image. But you know, the bottom line is that that matters, but probably not as much if someone who would never cite that is using it for disinformation. Being able to track that, I think, would be pretty important.
Absolutely.
Okay, other Google news that is of interest.
Can I ask you one question about that article? Is that the same one Adobe's doing? Because a few weeks ago, I think we had talked about an initiative that was to try to do this, have some watermarking. Is Google collaborating with Adobe and others, or are they going solo on this particular one? Do you know?
Not that I don't know the answer to that. I don't think the article speaks to that either.
Yeah, the word Adobe is not in there, so
same thing.
Probably.
So no, but that would be important because if we could come up with a de facto standard that four or five of the big players adopt, that makes it a lot easier to say this is the standard in that.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, that's great. Another interesting development this week. This is from a YouTube channel called Flipped Classroom, and the Flipped Classroom guy is showing off the new AI image generation tool in Google Slides, and it reminds me a lot of Canva's strategy, which is just to have it as part of the tool set. But now you can simply go to Google Slides, and I think you need to be in the, like, opted into the beta, maybe. And I don't think it's available in education yet. But if you go to Insert Image and then Help Me Visualize, that's actually a shorthand for saying Generate an Image from Scratch. And so I would describe it as maybe 6 months behind Midjourney in regards to its capability, but it's pretty good, especially if you're doing a simple picture, like I want a picture of a jellyfish. If you put that in to Help Me Visualize, it will create the image. It will give you a couple of options to work on. It does apologize because it takes up to 20 seconds, and I did laugh at that because anyone who is mad because it takes 20 seconds to conjure an image from scratch should probably mitigate their expectations. But now I just picked up 8 images of a jellyfish and then able to move it around a Google slide. And very powerful tool. It's pretty good quality. Right now it is, I guess for lack of a better way of putting it, I would say probably better in the minds of creative kids, right? Like as an adult, it wasn't giving me necessarily what I was looking for because I had very specific ideas in mind. But understanding that the kids are oftentimes much better divergent thinkers, I think in the hands of kids, it'll be pretty darn amazing.
And what is remarkable about this, generating, what did I say? Mountain scene with dragons flying over an active volcano. It's just so doggone easy to do. And if you've ever played with Midjourney, it is amazing. But you're typing that into a chat interface and it's kind of hard to find and it just is not super user friendly. It can generate some really amazing results, but I am part of an AI beta for Google. And so there it is. Help Me Visualize. That is amazing. Any news that you've heard in terms of a rollout to education?
I've not, although I was going to, that's actually on my research list because I want to find out more about that in part because I am super interested in finding out when it's available there. I imagine that part of the fear isn't necessarily the schools aren't ready for it yet, although schools are not ready for it yet, but the privacy and data concerns. I know having listened to a couple of tech directors, especially those that are the, do everything that plugs into power people in tiny school districts are very hesitant about this just because of the extraordinary data privacy rules that apply to students now that didn't exist even 5 years ago. But I'm assuming soon. And I do have a tool a little bit later this hour, Wes, that I'm going to show you that makes Midjourney look silly. I will have a good preview for you of that.
Okay, well, I have an article that I just heard about today on Hard Fork. We've now mentioned Hard Fork multiple times on the podcast. It's on both Jason and my regular list of podcasts to listen to. And frequent listeners of the show may remember the name Greg Rakowski. It's been several months ago, but we talked about him because he is a fairly amazing, what would we say? Sort of like Dungeons and Dragons. It's, I'm trying to say sci-fi. Whatever you call, fantasy. There you go. So like when it comes to, dragons and wizards and all kinds of things like that. So the articles from Futurism on August 2nd, I think it was in the latest hard fork. Maybe it was the week before. But the headline is, Guy puts artist back into AI system after he begs to be removed. So one of the things that was happening in the early days, this was only a few months ago, of generative AI with tools like Midjourney, is that when you wanted to have a pretty amazing image and you wanted it to, have this really distinctive fantasy look, Greg Rakowski is a phenomenal artist, and all of his works on the internet had been ingested into these tools. And so Stable Diffusion, which is an open source AI tool, and it's been lagging behind ChatGPT and Midjourney and things like that, but he had begged the developers to go ahead and remove him and remove his works from the training data. And they did that. But it's an open source tool. And what does that mean? Well, a lot of things, but among others, basically anybody can create their own fork of the project. And so some people went ahead and created a fork that put him back in there. And so this is, I guess, maybe a commentary on the effectiveness of some of the lawsuits and some of the hand-wringing that we hear with creatives who are trying to force companies to pay them to, be included, or say, hey, I need to be able to opt out. And, open source tools are not going to be able to be controlled in the same way that a proprietary tool could. So had you heard that on Hard Fork or run into that?
No, I've not heard that yet. And that sounds like a fascinating story. But I'm also keep thinking about, a lot of the major open source, a lot of the major LLMs are open source, right? And also in a lot of cases, there's really nothing to sue there. You can sue, but, and exactly what you suggest, Wes, that the model itself, could be compelled to take out this or that. And I would imagine a lot of open source advocates would also say, yeah, get the copyright stuff out of there. We don't want it anyways. But in the end, it's available, right? You can just download it yourself it wouldn't be illegal for you to possess that.
And this is really fascinating because it didn't have to be this way. The founder of Stability AI that's behind Stable Diffusion, apparently a very, very wealthy hedge fund manager. And my understanding is that this particular person took a lot of umbrage over companies like Microsoft or OpenAI or you name it, or governments controlling such a powerful technology. And so that's why his company, Stable Diffusion, chose to open source their tools. Now, AI has been compared by some very smart people to nuclear weapons in terms of its power. And there was a large petition we talked about a few weeks ago on the show that was circulated, where basically everyone just said, this needs to be treated like very powerful and potentially dystopian technologies like nuclear weapons. And a lot of people signed that. And so this dynamic of, wealthy individuals and organizations acting to open source these kinds of tools, I think probably portends a lot of negative results, because I'm not saying, there's a large lack of faith in institutions and organizations, but the ability for nation states or any kind of governing bodies or standards bodies to be able to regulate AI is really, really small when open source is in the mix and it's not just a proprietary thing or something that nation states are controlling. And so I think that given the potential consequences and negative consequences of unregulated AI, I think this is fairly bad. But as the Futurism article says, it's out. The Pandora's box is open. It's yeah. out, and I've not read anything or heard anything that makes it sound like anybody can put that back in the box.
Yeah. And the other thing too, I mean, I think part of the demand that we slow down on AI research was that things like this were going to happen. And if the pace is too quick, it's going to be difficult for us to do mid-course corrections. But I also think too, that because of the frenzy around it, I just don't think it's really even possible for us to slow it down. I mean, there could be thoughtful companies that do it right, and maybe you continue to learn from the lessons of mistakes that are made. I keep thinking about Anthropic. Claude AI now is my primary tool. It is amazing. I keep finding new things to do with it. I've been putting meeting minutes in it for meetings that I can't attend, public meetings I can't attend or watch. And I have a text expansion snippet that says, talks about what my job is and what I do. Please summarize this article or these meeting minutes for me, pointing out the 5 or 10 things you think I should take from it. I've done that probably 25 times in the last 2 weeks.
Wow.
And 4 times there were things that I would have skipped right over because it's 200 pages, reports, and minutes that I was able to then hone in on something important. And
that is an absolutely incredible example of profession changing use of AI right now.
Yep.
I'm reminded of, and I blogged about this, there was a conference here at the start of August, several different conferences were about AI. And I think I put a post up. It was called Stephen Wolfram on Computational Thinking. And Stephen Wolfram, founder of Wolfram Alpha and just an incredible mind. He talked about how one of the things that he does is he regularly has all the new, AI and machine learning articles. He has the abstracts summarized and put into more clear language. Because even though he's a scientist and he's incredibly smart, like abstracts are not always written in ways that you can readily scan them and ingest them. And so that's one of the ways that he is staying on top of his field. So that is really, I think, phenomenal. And what could that mean for governance, right? When you think about a particular nonprofit that you might be involved with and its interest in the community, think about being able to set up automated workflows so that the open minutes, or it doesn't even need to be this, if it's on YouTube, the transcripts of the meeting can be ingested into the AI model. And hey, we are the Veterans Association of Central North Carolina, or the solar energy enthusiasts or whatever. But anytime something like that is, I think that could have some pretty exciting implications for governance in terms of, like you said, drawing your attention to things that you might have not had any idea they were discussed or highlighted.
Yep, that's totally.
That's awesome.
And, and I was using this tool this past spring too. This is an early tool, but I think I talked about on the podcast, there's a tool called Glisp, I think, if I remember correctly. Let me see, make sure I got the name right. Glasp, GLASP, and Glasp, they call it a social web highlighter and YouTube summary, but it basically adds a button to YouTube that you click on it, and it takes the full transcript from the closed captioning, opens it up in a new window with ChatGPT, and says, summarize this in 5 points or less. And it always does a really, really good job. And even when it was, I pay for ChatGPT Pro, so I have 4.0, 3.5 is what it defaulted to, because that's what always happens in a new window with ChatGPT. And even with 3.5, it was great. But when I was looking through YouTube videos this past spring to use in a class I was teaching at the U, and I didn't want to put any time into watching a video unless I knew it was something that was worth me watching, right? So there's, you know, 9 videos on this topic. And I want to, before I, you know, as I'm vetting them, I don't want to have to watch 9 videos. So I would wait for something that looks like it was in the realm of what I was looking for and then spend my time in on that. And the time savings process here is extraordinary.
Now, did that break as a result of ChatGPT's change in the number, the amount of text it can ingest? Because I think I had used it, but then it wasn't working. And so, like, even for our show, I'll use YouTubeTranscript.com or something like that, which grabs the entire transcript. I throw it into a Google Doc. I make it a PDF. I throw it into Claude, and then it's able to summarize the whole thing. Because I had used some of these tools that would, like, break things into 5 pieces and whatever, and it was just a little bit cumbersome. So I haven't used Glasp in a few months.
Well, yes, broken. In that, you know, for longer videos, it clearly, you know, kind of caps out there. But I had no idea that YouTube Transcript existed. So thank you, Dr. Fryer, for yet another wonderful tool for my toolbox.
There you go. Well, and in the you're welcome. In the heart, in the spirit of AI attribution, what I include in each of our EdTech Situation Room podcast descriptions at the end. This is the one I've used the last couple times. AI disclosure: an initial draft of this episode summary was generated using YouTubeTranscript.com and Claude AI, as well as options for our show title. Because that's the other part of the prompt that I'll use is come up with 10 very clever 3-word options, you know, based on the summary that you've written in this transcript. And I've gone with some before, and I'm not always going with them, but. Yeah, for as an assistant for the creative process, wow.
Yeah.
Good stuff.
Yeah, it just keeps getting more freaking interesting. So so we'll go from there. I want to point out a couple other quick Google things, then we'll move on to the many other articles we have for this week. This one is from Chrome Unboxed on April 25th. They're reporting about Google's Help Me Write AI is coming to Chromebooks system-wide. And the article is really interesting because it has a number of functionalities that are in beta and alpha right now that essentially allow Google Bard-like services to appear anywhere you can type. So in other words, it's not just a bot anymore. If you got anything from, well, anywhere you could enter text in, you can essentially right-click, and Google will pop up a dialogue to help you write whatever's in there. So whether you have AI tools or not, or you're using an AI-based tool or not, as long as it's typable, then the tool set is there. It also will have a bubble you can bring up to have more of a chatbot-like experience, but they're really integrating it at the core of the service. So, you know, and I'm sure that at some point this will be a play for Apple and a play for Microsoft as well. I think it's interesting that Google's first to market on this, from the, you know, integrated from the ground up, anywhere you type can be AI generated. But, first of all, you know, Chromebooks are just fine, right? They're a good, powerful platform. Unless you are stuck with a really slow one, never assume that a Chromebook is not going to get the job done, because it probably will. But that integration from the ground up is super fascinating to me.
Boy, are we ever going to need professional development around the question of helping students write with AI.
Yep.
Because here it is, and it's just going to be right there, nothing more than a secondary right click on the Chromebook. That's phenomenal. Okay. You want to do some more Google, or are we ready to jump to another topic?
Let me see what articles we have there. Let's move on to something else.
Okay. So I put this under, I'll do a notable nugget, and then I've got a couple social media ones. The U.S. Cyber Trust Mark finally gives device makers a reason to spend big on security. This is from TechCrunch on August 23rd. In addition to enjoying the Hardfork podcast. Tech-wise, I'm still listening to the Twit This Week in Tech every once in a while, and I even started listening to Security Now, which I haven't listened to for a while. And I think I got this on – I know I got it on one of those. I think I might have gotten it on Twit. One of the big issues when it comes to security – oh, gosh, no, it was a different podcast – is like, who do you trust? And is the firmware going to be updated? According to the article, it says last year, more than 110 million IoT, Internet of Things, malware attacks took place. And that was an 87% increase in the previous 12 months. What are we talking about? You know, smart devices. You've got smart light bulbs, switches, you know, thermostats, different things that people are putting into their homes. And these devices are computers. They have chips in them. They have firmware in them, and they can be hacked. One of my favorite things, and I think I'm going to do a little security unit with my, I'm teaching both a computer programming class and a web design class, which I'm loving both of those this year. But I think with my web design, I'll do a unit on security and talk about the hack, you know, that involved Minecraft and mm-hmm. when these kids figured out how to hack, you know, thousands and thousands of IoT devices. And the main motivator was they wanted to be able to take down their opponents who were hosting, you know, Minecraft servers. So anyway, how are you going to know what to trust? Well, the United States, the White House announced this in July. They have a U.S. cyber trust mark, and it's part of its voluntary labeling program for smart devices. And so it's similar to what the EU has done with their Cyber Resilience Act. And so the article in TechCrunch is saying that compliance is going to be more cost effective as a result. And so this is going to be important signaling for us as consumers to be able to look for devices that have this mark, because there's going to be some commitments that the manufacturers are going to be making to cybersecurity. And hopefully it's going to be a quality seal that will mean something, but it's pretty new and I hadn't heard anything about that. And we talk about IoT and security and things like that from time to time. And so as I purchase new IoT devices, I'll look for the cyber trust mark. I don't know exactly when that's going to be on products. I know you, I think, posted a link today to a JBL speaker that has both, you know, Madam A as well as the G assistant in them. So it's just something to look for sort of on the consumer side as we're looking at devices and thinking about security.
Awesome. Okay, where to next, sir?
Let's do a couple social media ones. Following your lead with AI, I went ahead and put this in the social media category, but this was the Washington Post, also a gift link from August 25th. Following Elon Musk's lead, big tech is surrendering to disinformation. And so this is actually really sad. We have definitely covered on the show and talked before about not only, you know, replatforming of different individuals who were previously taken off of Twitter, but also just an increase in, you know, harassment and persecution of folks on Twitter. Well, unfortunately, Meta, Facebook, you know, led by Mark Zuckerberg, has had mass cutoffs, gutting teams that were dedicated to promoting accurate information. And basically, you know, this is really poorly timed with the 2024 primaries and election that are coming up, because there is just a lot less, There are far fewer resources that are available now in these tech companies with, you know, ever increasing quantities of shared information. The article points out that Russia and China have grown more aggressive in terms of their covert influence campaigns. And then generative AI, as we talk about every show, has created new tools for, you know, misleading voters and creating disinformation and sowing confusion. And so you know, it's not a great thing, but I had really kind of thought that might have been limited to Twitter, but evidently, you know, Facebook and other big tech companies have kind of followed the lead and said, and part of that, I think, is there can be such a pushback when it comes to some of that censorship. And so, you know, if things are political and polarizing, even if they're false, for instance, we had you know, things about voting, and an example was something that would try to tell somebody the election was a different day, or their polling place was in a different location because they wanted to try to reduce the you know, turnout. Things like that, you know, have been blocked. And so, of course, there's promise that AI tools are going to be able to fill in the gap, but that hasn't proven to be the case. So anyway, that was kind of a surprise. And then one more, this is kind of a quick one, and this is local. Charlotte-Mecklenburg is our large county, and we have county schools here in North Carolina. I forget how many hundreds of thousands of students they have. Charlotte-Mecklenburg County has filed a lawsuit against social media companies over the health impacts, and they've joined other districts and organizations doing that. So they filed against, and this was an article from August 25th in WSOC-TV. They filed against Meta, Facebook, Google, ByteDance for TikTok, Snap for Snapchat, quote, saying their products have been, quote, causing harm to students, damaging youth mental health, and burdening school districts, according to a news release on Friday. And so in terms of a tech correction with all of this, I don't have this article, but again, that latest Hard Fork podcast actually is a very good discussion about potentially maybe unintended consequences over some of the proposed legislation for quote, internet safety in terms of proving identity. And, you know, it remains to be seen where all this is going to go, but some of that proposed legislation is asking social media companies basically to forecast, you know, what kinds of speech and what kinds of content might potentially harm students in the future. And if you share that, you're going to be open to lawsuits and have a liability. You're going to have liability, a threat of being able to be sued, I guess. So anyway, that was interesting that was happening locally.
Yeah, totally. Well, and I also think too that, and I have extremely mixed feelings about this, but what I've noticed over the last 2 years is that it's now becoming cool to say that, you know, well, we don't like phones and we don't like tech and we want techless this and we want techless that. And the reason why it's mixed for me is because I do think that there is a lot of research that says if you're mindlessly just letting kids, you know, dicker around with devices, that is not an effective use of class time and probably increases unsavory behaviors amongst our students. But, you know, thoughtfully implemented and with really clear mission, you know, you can still, I think, do great ed tech stuff. And, you know, like everything, and my entire life seems to be a lesson in this for myself. Like, it's never one or the other, right? It's always somewhere in the middle. And, you know, let's not, you know, and I think it's particularly true in our current political climate that it's really easy to try to find a right answer and then just pound on that button to see what happens. But I think that's a foolhardy game. And I don't think it serves our students well to say that schools are completely tech-free zones.
And one of the things the Hard Fork podcast pointed out is it's not just the letter of the law and the requirements it's going to put on. It's also the chilling effect that it has on companies that have a product, a profit motive and an incentive to avoid litigation. And so, it's the tech correction is still here. And, I mean, because we've got all kinds of consequences, as you say, to social media, but there's certainly not consensus on what to do. And in the effort to try to do something, it remains to be seen, you know, what kinds of big impacts that might have on the internet overall and things that go far beyond, you know, youth wellness and health and things like that.
Yep. Couldn't agree more.
All right.
Okay. Yeah. Let's go ahead. Big event coming up. The event title is Wanderlust, which I would have been accused of having much myself because I love to travel the world. And the graphic is a evolving apple that's kind of have metal tones to it with things flying off of it. Of course, what everyone loves to do is go and take a look at the invite and the image and the name and try to detect what's interesting there. But what I think is the most likely scenario is that iPhone 15 will be announced, There will be somewhere between 3 and 4 varieties of the iPhone, from big to small, pro to not pro. And other than expanding out the so-called dynamic island to all of the devices, the only other thing that will be new-ish will be USB-C connectivity, which has been all but confirmed by rumor links. And so we'll see. I mean, Apple surprised me before, where I was pretty thrown off by their headset earlier this year. So the bottom line is that they are never not full of surprises. But I guess I'll start here, Wes. Assuming an iPhone 15 comes out, are you a candidate for this phone?
I went ahead and picked up the 14, you know, a year ago after.
Yeah.
I mean, I was very happy with used phones for quite a while.
Yeah.
I will say, you know, the camera has just been absolutely phenomenal. Being able to live stream on, you know, 5G, you know, I thankfully haven't had to use the SOS feature when I was outside of regular cellular coverage to, you know, basically call 911 in an emergency. I wouldn't want to do that, but being able to have, you know, its features, I don't think so. But I am really excited about the USB-C connectivity, because for a while when I was back in Oklahoma, I had, I guess, an iPad Pro with USB-C, and it was really nice to be able to travel and not have to, you know, just to be able to use my same USB-C charger for my laptop with my iPad. And so I think that's going to be good. But of course, it's going to throw schools into some turmoil. And actually, our school, which were iPad 1-to-1, just rolled out new iPads, I think, to ninth graders this year. I think kids get a new device every 3 years. And these were the first USB-C devices, which sounds exciting. But when all of your chargers are Lightning, and when all of your, you know, video adapters are Lightning, then, you know, you're caught in this situation where you're going to have to have multiple ones available, and, you know, one size isn't going to fit all. But I think the transition to USB-C is definitely where we need to go. And I think we can thank Europe for that, right? Because I think they're the ones that really pushed Apple to say, you have to do this. This is a standard. And because Europe's getting it, I think we're getting it, if I read those tea leaves and articles correctly.
Yep. Well, and one of the things that's been kind of delight the last 6 months or so is that I feel like I'm finally getting back to pre-pandemic levels of, for example, my travel bag, right? Like, I, because I'm a nerd and kind of obsessive about stuff, you know, I make sure that I have a very, 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 very thoughtful daily carry bag and what I'm carrying my laptop in and such. And of course, I'm always, you know, maybe too concerned about power, but, you know, to your point about USB-C being so great, I mean, one of my strategies and the reason why I'm able to just produce this is because they were sitting in my pocket, but, you know, in my little daily carry bag, when I have my chargers with me, I cap off a USB-C cable with one of these USB-C to Lightning converters. So I have the opportunity to essentially, you know, make that into a multi-cable. And, you know, yeah, I think it would be really great to get to that point too. And I mean, I do agree with some folks that say that USB-C is still kind of confusing about how it's implemented and which chargers do what. But if you, for the nerds, right, if you're a non-nerd, you don't care about this, but I do. You know, knowing what you can use, making sure you have the right cables, and knowing how much your charger's output, so you can always be kind of on top of your charging needs, remains a cool thing to do to kind of stay on top of that process. So I'd be looking forward to that too. And I will say, I do have an iPhone 13 Pro right now, not the Pro Max, but the Pro. And it's actually interesting because I also know from my friends that have the Pro Maxes in the last couple of generations, they're just a lot heavier than the Pro, like noticeably heavy. But I'm also on T-Mobile's device exchange program, so I'm due up for a new iPhone this year from them. They'll buy back my old one, and I believe give me the phone with credits, if I remember correctly, for a nominal fee. So yeah, I'll be updating for sure. And my strategy would be to go with, assuming there's, I don't like the Max because I'm always carrying a tablet with me, so I don't need a big phone, right? But if I could go with, you know, the Pro model that's a little smaller, I think I'd be in for an update.
What I'm going to have to do is take stock of the other phones in our family inventory. Our son is getting married in September, and I think that will be the point at which we'll go ahead and take him off our family T-Mobile plan. but and you know, so he'll have responsibility for his own phone updating. But for both our daughters and my wife, I think the 11 Pro that our youngest has might be the oldest phone that we have. And so anyway, yeah, we'll need to take stock of that, but probably do the same kind of weighing of, you know, is it really going to be worth this? And, you know, what's Swappa doing? So, you know, yeah. The 13, the 14, these are going to be priced even better after the 15, you know, hits the market. So I think we've covered some articles about this, but people are just generally not turning over their iPhones and their smartphones as quickly as they have sometimes in the past. And of course, Apple and all smartphone manufacturers would like to keep that churn going. And so there'll be different kinds of incentives and I'm sure an amazing presentation. So we've said this before, but if nothing else, watch the introduction to the Apple event, because they always, you know, pull off some pretty clever videography. And I think they really define best practice in, you know, a video production quality as far as what they're doing. So I mentioned, I think I've watched now about half of the WWDC presentation from the summer and still need to go look at it, because the new version of iOS will be announced as well. And there's some pretty compelling things that it's going to have in it. Some of it's just, you know, cool stuff, but you know, all those features add up. So we're fanboys. Hey, why don't I want to share an Air Force drone AI article, and then maybe you want to talk about your amazing tool, because I don't want
to
run too far and miss out on that. Okay, so this was actually my geek of the week today for my media literacy. I have two sections of middle school media literacy, and this is an article from the New York Times from August 27th, and it's called AI Brings Robot Wingman to Aerial Combat. And a number of years ago, I was in Washington, D.C. with our son, I think, and the Air and Space Museum had just started their new exhibit for drones. And of course, one of the things that's interesting about this is there's so much secrecy surrounding drones and the drone programs. So this article talks about a drone I had not actually heard of, the pilotless XQ-58A Valkyrie. And it's run by AI. And as you scroll down, you'll see photographs of not only the aircraft, but also a pilot who is now testing flying with this thing. And so basically, there's a couple of generals that are involved, and then the test pilot, I think his name is Ross Elder, saying, "I'm flying off the wing of something that's making its own decisions, and it's not a human brain." And so what in this article, they say that the inventory of the U.S. Air Force, and full disclosure, our daughter's at the Air Force Academy now. I'm just kind of a little more in tune and following, you know, some different things having to do with the Air Force because of that. The Air Force in the United States has fewer aircraft and older aircraft than we ever have since World War II. And part of what the U.S. Air Force has proposed doing, and the Pentagon looks to be, you know, doing and assuming all the congressional funding is going to be in place, is a lot like what sounds like Star Wars. So I actually showed a landing scene from Star Wars Phantom Menace Episode 1 today in class and talked about drones, because the vision is you're going to have human pilots with multiple full-sized, you know, drone aircraft, but these are going to cost something like $3 million apiece versus like, what, $30 million apiece for the F-35. And so these aircraft are going to be able to go in by themselves, but they're also going to be, you know, flying with their human pilot, but they're going to be able to make their own decisions in dogfighting and in releasing ordnance and dropping bombs and shooting missiles. And the United States, if you're not following this, right, there's a huge military buildup that's happening right now. And I've heard some leaders talk about 2025 being the point at which China may exceed the United States in military capabilities. And so with all of the missile defenses and everything else that China has, this is part of how the United States sees itself being able to counter that threat is not going to be with human pilots and $30 million or $35 million F-35s, but a smaller number of human pilots and F-35s and hundreds, if not thousands, of these drone aircraft. So kind of mind blowing, and there's a lot to unpack there and talk about.
Yep. There you go.
All right. What about this fascinating AI tool?
Oh, Dr. Fryer. So you mentioned Midjourney earlier, and I spent a lot of time with Midjourney. It's an extraordinary tool, and it's part of my standard presentation now for educators about, you know, how great the tool is and how interesting and also a little scary the tool is. And then I'm 99% sure that Ethan Mullick from the Wharton School is where I picked up this link from. But this is currently free. I did not get a chance to look at the terms of service, and I can't find them now that I'm signed in. Like, I think I'd have to create a new account using the terms of service again, which seems a little problematic. But the interface is a lot like Instagram in that it's kind of a mix between a social media sharing tool and an AI tool or an AI image tool, but it creates the most stunning images that are accurate to the prompt that I have seen in AI in general. And it can do really anything. I mean, like, for example, if you ask Midjourney to create a sign, it's just going to create a sign that looks like a sign, but the text on there will be blah, 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 right? It's just, it looks right, but it's not actually English words, right? It's just, you know, mimicking that. This will create English words. So for the example, I'm looking at a prompt that says, Baby Yoda holding a sign, let us delete our images, please, cinematic, natural light. And here is a picture of Baby Yoda holding a sign that says, let us delete our images. This one, do you want negative prompting in neon, typography, 3D render? And it shows what is a cinematic photograph of a neon sign that says, do you want negative prompting? This is a Mad Magazine cover with former President Trump on it as Alfred E. Newman. This is a sticker. I'm not weird. I'm limited edition typography. Sticker of Weird Al Yankovic in glasses, mustache detail. Completely renders it from top to bottom. And it is by far the most powerful tool I've seen yet in generating stuff with really simplistic prompts.
Do you know who the company is behind it or anything about the AI model that's using?
Nothing about it other than holy dog, is it interesting.
Well, and what another great example of how we can be the filters for each other, right? Because Ethan Mullick, you've talked about before, he was a guest on Hard Fork. I listened to that episode, by the way, and it was excellent. His analysis, because he's really, especially with higher education, probably one of the foremost experts on AI and faculty adjustment and things like that. Let me see if I can actually share my screen, because this won't help the folks who are listening to this as an audio podcast, but I'm going to go ahead and say share my screen, and I'm going to try to share. Can I just do one thing at a time? All right. Here is the Google Slides version of Mountain Scene with dragons flying. And there were, you know, four different ones, and okay, that's okay. There were a couple options there. Now I really haven't done a lot of presenting here with
screen. Yeah, I would describe that as generally accurate, recognizable, but still a little on kind of the artsy side.
Yeah, it looks a little bit more iconish. And so anyway, here's the exact same prompt in Ideogram. But again, I would say the same thing about both tools. Compared to Midjourney and what you had to do in Discord in order to get that to work and just how cumbersome it was. I mean, I've wanted to do actually like an EdTech playdate, which we've done before with different tools where you just kind of get together and have some people who know a few things about some tools, but play with them and people share and learn together. And I still think that would be great. But part of my hesitation of doing this with like our art teachers and stuff is I didn't play with Midjourney long enough to feel extremely fluent and conversant with the tool. But these tools are, you know, point and click. Have you done iteration with them to, can you refine them in the same way that you can with Midjourney to say, okay, I want you to use that one and play with it some more, or is it kind of take it or leave it?
Well, now that you say that, though, hold on. I'm going to say...
Oh, there is a remix. There's a remix.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to just try out. Montana is the best state ever. Let's see what that provides me. And by the way, the text rendering here is just unbelievable. And by the way, I then took one of these images today. I upscaled it using the upscale AI. I then sent it off to someone online that will draw a vector out of it, and now I have a vector logo for something. Like, and it's pretty impressive stuff. So I have a mountain. I have a mountain scene that actually looks very Montana-ish. I'm clicking remix, and so we can take that image, and then you can ask it to, you know, to modify it in some way. Yeah, that's amazing.
To iterate. Yeah, that really is. And then there's, as you generate, there are these, you know, all these different style choices that you can have, you know, that are menu driven. So I think this is just phenomenal. I mean, okay, but I do have this question, and if you don't have this, maybe we can reach out to others. What are the implications for students who are under 13? I'm teaching middle schoolers, I do have some 13-year-olds, but, you know, we're using Padlet, and it's got a I can't draw option, and it's licensed, and we can have tools that kids can use with permission, but this is kind of a hazy part of schools and ed tech. And I think what schools are supposed to do if you are using something outside of the approved, you know, Google suite, is I think that you're supposed to have some individual permission, or you're supposed to put those tools in the sign off that parents are saying, yes, they can do this. But I don't think that is followed a lot. And I think that has something to do with Google itself and some of the changes that they made in the admin console, where now everybody's age is noted. And there's some tools that just don't work at school because the developers didn't put the hooks in to say, oh, yes, we got to check, you know, if kids, what kids' ages are and things like that. So anyway, yeah, if anybody out there listening has done some work, I'm going to reach out to Eric Kurtz. He is presenting prolifically all over the country about AI and education. And so I'm going to, he would be a really good person to ask about that. So we'll see. We'll report back.
Okay. Well, Wes, I think, by the way, I pay for Midjourney, I pay for ChatGPT, and now in the last 48 hours, I'm only using Claude, and I'm only using Ideogram or whatever you pronounce this. So, but yeah, pretty amazing stuff. So,
okay.
Well, Dr. All Fryer, right. We seem to be now past the top of the hour, so unless there's anything we need to cover today.
Shall we Geek of the Week quickly?
Although let's do it. Dr. Fryer, go ahead.
Okay, so this was actually my first video that I upscaled the Google slide generated thumbnail using the upscale tool that Jason has shared. But I am in the midst of my family oral history project with my middle schoolers. Just love this. And finally, and it's taken me a while to do this, I've been such a fan of the iOS app Voice Record Pro, which is free and all this, but kids have to download it. Well, guess what? Voice memos comes free on every iPad, and my kids don't have to install anything. It's right there and it works great. And so I'm just having my kids use voice memos, share it to Drive. And then today they were just actually downloading it because we're using a laptop, you know, in our room as well, and sort of skipping some of the sharing complexities that can happen there, and just directly putting that on Padlet and then sharing a link. But yay for sharing voice memos, and that's a tutorial link, and you can get in the description of that, or I also have the other link to my full lesson, and I'm going to be updating that in, I would say the next week. But anyway, love that unit, love that lesson, and, you know, changing tools is part of what we oftentimes need to do for different reasons, and I'm glad to have done that because it's making it even faster and easier for my kids to not even have to worry about getting a new app to be able to do their classmate and then ultimately their family interview. How about you?
Well, I want to share one of the reasons why I think there may be other stuff at the Apple event is because there's been a lot of sales on Apple laptops in the last 2 weeks at third-party sellers. But I wanted to highlight that the baseline MacBook Air M1 is on sale at Amazon right now for $750. It's 25% off. And I will tell you, because this very laptop is my daily driver, if you are a Mac person and you're still sitting around with a 2016 MacBook Air or something, this is a really inexpensive way to get into the universe. It only has 8 gigs of RAM, but it honestly doesn't matter because you notice the 16 gigs of RAM on those machines, but I never feel like I'm limited with 8 on the device. And I think these devices are 6-8 year purchases easily. Especially with Apple silicon chips. So currently on Amazon, 25% off, $750, your choice of colors, pretty hard to beat.
Totally true. I'm on an M1 8 gig RAM machine right now, super fast. That's the machine that I had at my previous school, and I just couldn't be happier. I don't know that I need any more speed.
No, I certainly don't either. Yep. Okay, Dr. Fryer, where can people find you on the interwebs?
They can go to westfryer.com/after, and you'll have more links than you even want to click on. How about you?
Well, I'm still kind of on Twitter, TechSavvyTeach, although I'm thinking about maybe trying to be more on Mastodon. Who knows? Especially since, they're encouraging disinformation now on Twitter. But hey, this isn't complaints about Twitter. It's the Internet Situation Room. We're a once-a-week podcast on Wednesday nights at 7 p.m. Mountain Time, 9 p.m. Eastern Time, somewhere in the middle of the night, UTC. If you can't join us live, and I wish you would, please download our podcast anywhere finer podcasts are aggregated, or go to edtechsr.com to download a tiny MP3, edtechsr.com/links to check out all of our information. And otherwise, we're available throughout the internets wide. Stay safe, stay savvy. We hope to see you next time on the EdTech Situation Room. Good night.
Good night.